Myself, it didn't work for some reason. So thank you, Tom, for your laptop. I'm Long Lee. I'm from Microsoft. So last year at SDC in California, I presented work on the SMB Direct for SIFS, for Linux SMB Client. So since then, we have gone through.
Yes,
because my voice is so slow. Did that sound okay?
How about this?
Okay, so since then we have done couple rounds of kernel reviews by the community, and then the catch is now the patch size is in the kernel. So that's good news. And then with some help with some friends with Mellanox, Chelsea, and also the Samba folks, we were able to improve the performance as well as improve the reliability of the RDMA. So today's talk is a refresh and also update on the current status of the RDMA work for Linux SMB client. So SMB Direct is a protocol for transferring SMB packets over RDMA. It first came out with Windows 2012 as SMB 3.0. And then it has two updates, SMB 3.02 and SMB 3.11. So for the purpose of the implementation, the difference we care about is the invalidation that's introduced in SMB 3.02. So in terms of those two SMB versions, 3.02 and 3.11, the implementation is almost the same, except for possible configuration parameter changes. And of course, being RDMA, that means that we support all the RDMA transport. We support InfiniBand, Rocky, or IWAP. So it's interesting, actually, there are two ways to transfer data with SMB Direct or RDMA. We can transfer through RDMA sender receive. That's similar to transferring data through a socket interface, in that we just send data to the interface and wait for data to be sent. But there's no data copy in the software stack, unlike TCP/IP, where it may buffer the data for the purpose, maybe doing something with a TCP window. And then for RDMA, we also have a read-write. This is more interesting data transfer method in RDMA, in that it uses hardware to do all the work. It has no CPU involvement. So in that way, we save a lot of CPUs, and also we can potentially overlap CPU and the communication over the link. So we see that in the benchmarks on those two ways to transfer data. And then from the programming perspective, talking to RDMA hardware, we basically talk to QPAL in RDMA. QPAL is the way that the software tells hardware what work to do. For example, if software wants to send some data, it sends something to the QPAL. It's called a work request. And then hardware pick up those requests and send the data. And then after the I/O finished, and the hardware use completion queue to tell software that the data is finished and you can do something else. Of course, there are many other stuff in RDMA layer to deal with the setup, but basically QPAL and the completion queue are the only stuff we care about when doing the data I/O. And of course, for QPAL, RDMA support three types of QPALs. For the context of SMB Direct, we choose to use a reliable connection. Reliable connection is a QPAL that's similar, very similar to TCP in that it's guaranteed the packet always arrive in order, and then the packet doesn't have any corruption. So in practice, RC QPAL is very, very reliable. You can run IOs for like days or even weeks without any connection drop on a good RDMA link.
Long, it's more than that. RC is required for SMB rep, and second, it's the only one that supports true RDMA. The other ones are messaging, they're like datagrams only. So no direct message.
I agree with that. So there's something different, because why do we need a protocol to transfer data through RDMA? Why we can just transfer data through RDMA? It's because in RDMA, really nobody in the software stack will buffer the data. There's only one copy of the data in the software stack. Now the hardware may buffer the data in the actual hardware and do the data transfer, but in the software we only have one copy. So that brings an interesting program. If you send data, the other end, for example, if SMB client sends something through RDMA to the server has to have a data buffer ready for that transfer. If the server doesn't have any buffer, then this RDMA transfer will fail. And that is not good news for the SMB client. We have to deal with this failure and retry it. And so for SMB Direct, we have to figure out a way to transfer the data between those two servers. Then that's the purpose. We need a protocol for doing that. So if you look at the how RDMA send or receive data through the RDMA link, first, the IO data is sent through the upper layer, which is SMB3 client in Linux. The data passed through the SMB Direct. Then SMB Direct need to partition the data to the MTU size that can be sent over the link. After that, the data is sent through the link, and then on the other side, it's getting reassembled and then passed the IO data back to the SMB3 layer. So because in RDMA, we need to make sure the buffer is already there when you transfer data, and then the server and the client must agree that data transfer can be made at that time. So we need to make sure that, they have agreed on something that on credit. So basically, SMB credit is the way that guarantee that when the client and server communicate with credit, they basically tell each other, how many buffers do I have to receive this data? If I give this credit to you, Yes, Matt?
I have a short question. I was also testing with SMB Direct, and what I found is that a Windows server grants me one more credit than I ask for, and that was unexpected for my client. Do you saw that also?
I'm sorry, can you?
So I'm asking for 255 credits, but the server grants 256. Now, 56. One more than I asked for.
So it's okay to server to give you more credit than you ask for. Because it's up to the server to allocate those buffers, not you. So if server give you more credit, you can just send more data to
you
server.
Can less than you ask for as well, if it's not possible.
Yeah, sure. That's just
a number. I'd have to look into why it returns more. It may simply be convenience on the
service.
Okay. So credits are important in SMB Direct. That's why the credits are in every SMB Direct packet. In the first two fields are the credits, and they exchanged in every packet in over the RDMA. Now there's one problem. So on a large, heavy IO situation, one side may send data and the other side keep receiving data. And soon the sending side is running out of credit because the receiving side doesn't have any chance to send anything back because it's busy doing receiving all the time and has no data to send. In this case, we need to send SMB Direct packet without payload. It's like a sync packet in TCP. You just give the peer some credit so the credit can, after the buffers are allocated, so the other end can keep sending data. So that's why in SMB Direct, we need to send, sometimes we see SMB packet without payload, and it has the packet header, but has no data. This is designed to deal with this heavy workload. So now with the direct write system in place, we can look at this send and receive again. So when the server is ready to receive data, it's basically allocating the data buffers for on the server, and it's based on how many buffers it has allocated, then it's tell this number to the client, tell this credit to the client. So the SMB client can know how many data can send. So based on this information, before the IO data is passed to the SMB direct, it makes sure it has enough credit to send this whole data packet. Only after it has the capacity to send it and the server can receive it, then it can break this IO data into pieces and send it to the server. Now we know server has all the buffers ready and the data can be safely sent. So it seems goes well, but there's a problem with this approach with SMB send and receive. Because the IO data is typically large, a large data, but MTU size on the link is typically small. It's typically less than 2K bytes. So RDMA is doing send and receive, is doing all the hard work of doing the packet, break the packet into pieces. And then at server side, those pieces are getting reassembled. It's maybe not the best way to do data transfer because even on today's TCP hardware, with SO and the hardware acceleration, this segmentation can be offloaded to the hardware. So if you have CPU doing all this work, that typically results in lower performance compared to TCP. So the solution that for the SMB Direct, in the context of SMB Direct, only use RDMA send and receive for smaller packets. Today's default is 4K bytes. Anything larger than that, we need to find another problem. Solution for that. So for the large packet, we have another way to transfer the I/O, which is read and write. RDMA read and write is interesting because when you do a RDMA read, it's actually the server doing the read. It's server, the I/O is initiated by the server, not client. The client we have the dial data and find some way to register data and put that information into the SMB packet header. So the client only needs to send the packet header to the server without any data payload in the packet. So that's a small packet. On the receiver side, SMB server will figure out in the SMB packet header that where the data is actually located. And then it's initiate RDMA read or write to get those data into the server. So this process, the actual I/O process of read and write is transparent to the client. Client doesn't know that it's being done by the server. The RDMA hardware is doing all the work. And after this I/O is done, the server will tell the client the I/O is finished. So in this way, we can transfer large amounts of I/O data without breaking it into smaller pieces in software. Hardware is doing all the work, but it's all transparent to software. Now we can fully, we don't need to deal with segmentation and the reassembly. That saves a lot of time. So in order to do this, the client needs to tell the server where the data is in its memory. And this process is called the memory registration. So in the kernel, we of course, device deal with hardware addresses. And we don't even need to have a virtual address mapped for those addresses. And the IO data is described as pages. We register this memory and pass this page into the RDMA hardware with the correct permissions on the pages. And then after that, the RDMA hardware registers this memory in its client hardware and send this over to the server. The server hardware and the client hardware can communicate and do the RDMA I/O on this region. So doing memory registration is important because we have to have the memory registered in the hardware before any I/O can be done. Then there's a problem with that because memory registration also takes some time. A typical sequence is that when the for example, client wants to register memory registration, and then need to wait for this process to finish. if it doesn't wait, then just send this request over to the server and that may create another problem. Is that maybe this registration is not finished yet, but the server reads the packet, the data is not there in the client memory. That's a problem because we need to know where data is when doing the RDMA I/O. And also that is also bad because when you want to wait something in the thread, there's a potential CPU context switch. And especially on the fast I/O path, the context switch is the last thing you want. But luckily, today's hardware, almost all RDMA hardware supports fast registration. In that, the registration request acts as a barrier on the hardware. Then in the queue pair, the hardware guarantees that the later work request always finished after the memory registration is finished. So that guarantees that when the request is sent over to the server, and this I/O is all the I/O region is properly registered and ready for RDMA. So that's important because we want to make sure the correct I/O is getting transferred. But this feature is supported on almost all modern hardware. That's why by default. In the context of Linux SMB Direct implementation, we use the fast registration for memory registration. So the good news is that in here we don't need to wait and resulting in another context switch on the CPU. So now we can look at how registration is done in the typical I/O. When first the I/O is registered, and then after it's registered, the registration information is put into the SMB packet header and sent to the server. And based on this packet header, the server decode and figure out how to do a RDMA read or write from that I/O region. Because as we can see, memory registration takes time and we don't want to waste time on that again and again in the client. So the design is to pre-allocate the memory registration on the client. So when it's ready to do the memory registration, it can quickly find out a slot and then register that block to the server. But there's a problem with that. The client doesn't have an unlimited resource of the memory registration. It's eventually will run out of those memory slots. Another reason that it doesn't have unlimited resources is that after memory the RDMA I/O is done, the I/O region has to be invalidated. This is important because when we return this I/O to the client, we want to make sure the server doesn't have access to that I/O region. But it's bad news if we return something to the client and the server is still writing to it. So that's why that's what invalidation does here. It basically tells the RDMA hardware the I/O region is no longer available to any RDMA I/O, and nobody will change that. This has to be done after I/O is done, before we return the I/O data to the client. So this step cannot be skipped, and we have to do that on all the RDMA I/O. And also this, of course, is not good news for us because that means we have to wait on something in the I/O path. And that's a potential context switch on that CPU. But luckily, starting with SMB 3.02 and also in 3.11, SMB servers support remote invalidation. What it means that when the SMB response comes back to the client, the I/O region is already invalidated. It's guaranteed by the server. This is the feature in the hardware. But today's hardware all support this, so that's good news. So it's not over yet. After the memory region is invalidated, the memory still needs to be deregistered from the system before it can be reused again. So again, this is another time-consuming process. So just like any other kernel memory design, when you allocate something, it's actually faster than deallocate something. Really because when you deallocate, it's so we need to reorganize the data back to some trees and then figure out how to make them ready for the next allocation. So the registration is done. We don't want to, of course, we don't want to deal with the registration when we return the I/O to the upper layer. It takes time and possibly another CPU context switch. So that's why this is referred to another background thread. It's doing this just for the registration. So it sounds simple, but in practice, it has another problem because now another thread is trying to share the resource with this I/O thread, and where maybe another I/O thread is doing the memory registration at the same time. So they all try to access the same data structure. So that implies locking in the system. But the last thing we want in the kernel is locking, because locking takes time and it's not scalable. It's not done right. So if you look at this step we do for RDMA read-write, it actually has three extra steps compared to RDMA send or receive. We have to do memory registration, invalidation, and deregistration. So the design is to, we want to make sure we don't do excessive locking for these three extra steps, because that would defeat the benefit of RDMA I/O. So that is where the background thread design come in here. When we look at memory registration in the system, can see they are limited. We don't have unlimited supply of memory registrations. The deregistration thread will try to recover those memory registration. It means that they want to modify this data structure as it goes along the linked list, where other CPU is probably trying to get those memory registration for I/O. And we don't want to block those other CPUs. So this is possible because they are trying to access different data structures. And then, as we can see here, they don't block each other on single thread background. We are looking at multiple thread because the benchmark will show later that deregistration is a bottleneck and sometimes something we can increase. So even RDMA has some failures, even RCQ pair, maybe in practice it can run for weeks without error, but error can still happen on RDMA. So in this case, when error happens, it's an interesting situation. To application, we don't want application to know about this I/O failure. Your application knows I/O has failed and it may have exit or do something else we don't want. Another reason is that the I/O may be issued from the page cache for doing page write back. And nobody wants to return a failure to the page cache. And that will slightly result in more problems. That's why in RDMA failure, we try our best not to return this failure to the upper layer. That this recovery is from the bottom to the highest layer. On the latest layer, lowest layer, we do recovery at RDMA layer. Every connection is reconnected, and all the resource data buffers are recreated on failure. On the RDMA layer, also session is reopened and the file is reopened. So at the end, the I/O, we keep the I/O around and reissue this I/O to the RDMA. So the end result is that to the VFS or page cache, they just proceed as if nothing has happened. It just takes more time, but eventually we make everyone happy. So look at the RDMA failure path. Remember that we have to deal with deregistration on those three steps. Now the memory registration need to, the RDMA failure needs us to modify the RDMA connection on certain occasions that we have to deal with these three steps. We need to lock on these steps. So this is again bad news. We try very best to not lock in on these three steps, but now we have to do that again. So luckily the Linux supports RCU that rely on CPU context switch to protect code. So basically RCU is designed to protect code, not data. But in this case, we happen to can use RCU to rely on context switch. On the R side is there's no cost, almost no cost. And CU takes all the time, but that's okay, because when we update the RDMA resources, it's for reconnection, and that happens very often in practice. So you need to design on the read side, we don't have overhead. That's good news for us. So let's look at the benchmark. So the test we run is Windows is with Linux kernel 4.17-RC6, which is a recent kernel about 2 months ago. And Windows Server is running SMB shell on RAM disk, because in this test we don't want to run, we don't want test caching or page cache on the Linux side. So everything is running on RAM. And then the switch is running on Mellanox 40G VPI switch, support both InfiniBand and Ethernet. As for the NIC, two NICs are used. Connect 3 is, Mellanox is used as 40G InfiniBand. It has 22G effective data rate. And ShareSeal 4T580 is used at the IWAP switch, NIC at 40G. The SIFT is mounted with, RDMA and, with version 3.02. In practice, 3.11 has similar results. 3.1 may be a little bit lower, but I don't see a significant difference. The test benchmark program is FFIO. And of course, we use direct IO to bypass all the caching on the server side. So here's the result of SMB read. As you can see that we are doing pretty good on large I/O sizes, especially starting from 1 megabytes. That's good news because the default VFS read ahead cache is 2 megabytes. So that means when we do large file copies, we should see the benchmark approaching to 1 megabytes or close to 4 megabytes. And also, ShareSeal is a little ahead of Mellanox because YWAP is only on 40G and all the 40G can be used for data. So the result is about 92% of utilization for Mellanox on 40G InfiniBand and 85% on ShareSeal on YWAP. Here's the test result on SMB write. It's a little lower than SMB read, because SMB write requires SMB server doing RDMA read. That means the server has to wait for the read to finish before send the request back to the client. So the result is a little lower than read. But again, we are at 90% for Mellanox and 76% for ShareSeal. So how does InfiniBand compile to IWAP? Again, this is a work in progress, so I'm still verifying this data, but it's interesting to see that even at low queue depths, the InfiniBand is slower than IWAP by a significant margin. So I'm still working for Mellanox and ShareSeal folks to better understand this. But basically, you see the trend is that still ShareSeal is outperforming Mellanox on most queue depths.
ShareSeal and Mellanox are highly hostile to one another. It's very unlikely that either one of them will give you a straight answer. I think you're going to have to figure it out.
Okay, thank you for your advice. For the 4 megabyte I/O, you see a similar trend. Basically, ShareSeal is ahead. And also, it doesn't show in this chart that ShareSeal results seem to fluctuate. Even the result shows the average value. So it's almost, it looks like ShareSeal is doing buffering in their hardware in some way that I don't understand. Okay, now go to the buffered I/O. By default, the SIFT always copy the user data from user space to kernel space. Of course, kernel and user need to work together, but by default, the kernel never trusts the user mode program. That's why SIFT always doing this, because the data cannot be trusted. And also, the data can be used for signing and encryption. So this is interesting because user may modify data at the same time, and this opens more surface area for user to play around with the kernel data. But it's good for caching because we can put the data in the page cache and you can speed up I/O. But there's a cost because the memory copy and the memory allocation always takes time. By the way, the chart shows the normal I/O path. It doesn't show the memory mapped I/O path, that is a different code path, but it presents the same problem here, that data has to be copied once and sent to the transport. So when you do that in RDMA read, you will see that the server is doing like 70% of the time doing memory copies, and then another 8% trying to allocate the pages with buffered I/O. So the work we recently have done is to implement direct I/O. in direct IO, data is passed directly to the kernel mode, from the user mode to the kernel mode, and passed in terms of RDMA direct to the transport. So no data is cached, and no page allocation or deallocation and mem copy. But this did increase the surface that the user mode can modify the stuff in the kernel mode because they are trying to access the same data here. The patch theory is real, and we are working hard to get this merged. Then to use direct IO, you can, there's two ways to do that. First, you can just mount the file system as cache equals none that we force all the IO to be direct IO. Or you can mount the system as normal mount and open the file with all direct. Some application will do that to get to the direct IO. So here's a comparison with direct IO versus non-direct IO. On the left side, you can see the direct IO is doing memory copies and page allocations. And on the right side, the left side is non-direct IO. The right side is direct IO. It doesn't do any memory copies and the page allocations. So in theory, it should save us some time when doing direct IO. So here's the result when doing the direct IO on InfiniBand. So for comparison purpose, all QDAPs equals one, because on lower QDAPs, there's no chance to overlap IO and the link transfer. So you see the best benefit here. As we can see that we see some good results starting on the larger packet size at 64K up to 1 MB. So here's the improvement with direct IO. But this is just one test run, so the actual result may vary, but in the end, you should expect to see about 20% increase for large IO sizes. Okay, so we still have something to do here. Because the first thing we want to do is multiple channels. Especially for the case of Chelsea, we still cannot reach the line speed. Multiple channel can help with that. Another issue I'm seeing here is the InfiniBand layers, RDMA support for file system. In that file system may send a large amount of data, and when you pull this data from InfiniBand, it's by default we are pulling with soft IRQ, that means we're pulling from the CPU interrupt mode. If the server is flooding the client with a lot of data, this pulling can take a really, really long time on the hard CPU in the interrupt mode. That means CPU cannot do anything else. If there's another thread scheduled on this CPU doing some work, then that's what cannot be done until CPU is out of interrupt. So this is bad. The solution I'm experimenting with is that move the polling to another CPU after a certain number of pulses, like 200 or 400, similar to DPDK done in the user mode. That may help in this case. The last one is NUMA. We see something in the MPI test. It's interesting that the NUMA is affect performance a lot, especially for memory copies. So the idea is to allocate different thread on different NUMA node and use that thread for the RDMA code. So this is future research. Questions?
We have 1 minute left for questions.
Yeah, Tom.
So NUMA affinity was shown to be really super important when we implemented SMB Direct in Windows.
Okay.
The IRQ stuff, there's a little bit of a NUMA issue hiding underneath there as well, because you don't always have control over what CPU you run on in soft IRQ. Tasklets would be a more obvious way to me to deal with some of this. Have you considered those?
It's a soft IRQ. The RDMA layer doesn't support tasklet. It's a soft IRQ, direct, or work queue. I think you're talking about work queue. Is that correct?
Yeah, I guess.
Work queue is running on CPU context. So in practice, it shows lower performance compared to soft IRQ.
Okay. There are many other ways to deal with this, a large number of packets. Hmm. Sometimes limiting your batch size, handing off to another work queue, another tasklet. You know, even though you've finished all your work and there's more work to do, you hand off anyway just to go back to the head of the tail of the queue. I would warn against too much tuning at that level, at this phase. There might be a lot of things to discuss there. It's certainly good to gather data, but in our experience, the data was it led us to in surprising directions, very surprising directions.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Have you used the VTune analyzer, the Intel's VTune or anything like that? You know, that use CPU specific performance counters?
No, I haven't tried that, but if you force the I/O to run a certain CPUs, you'll see some difference.
Oh yeah, big time. So, but VTune will tell you exactly which cache lines were ping-ponging and all kinds of really fascinating micro details.
So MPI already has this built-in the MPI library to set affinities on the libraries and then just bind this to a certain CPU for performance.
Okay.
So maybe I can experiment something here for RDMA. Yeah.
VTune's a proprietary tool. I don't think it's called VTune anymore. It's called like Intel Performance Analyzer or something. But it reads the Orange Book CPU specific registers. Fascinating stuff. Takes forever, but it's really interesting.
So officially we have a break.
Thank you.
If you insist, we could go on with questions.